The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Prices start at $9 per month. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's TECH for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can say that I get a lot of value out of them. Merck Research is different from other research, which usually just cherry picks all positive or all negative charts and then falls into the trap of confirmation bias. Merck Research provides an intellectually consistent approach by going through a consistent set of relevant data and then putting it through a consistent set of frameworks, which is then summarized in a checklist and in a concise written summary. Their monthly economic and market data review provides an excellent overview of the macro landscape. It's all compiled in one place and easy to interpret chart books with written analysis. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer and get a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website MerckResearch.com/contrarian. That's Merck spelled M-E-R-K. Or you can log on to MerckResearch.com, sign up for a regular subscription, and enter the code contrarian at checkout to take advantage of this free offer. Now on to today's episode. All right, Chris Krug of Chatham Harbor Capital Management, thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast today. We are talking to you about your investment strategy, which I have kind of loosely termed distressed investing. Now, traditionally, or correct me if I'm wrong, most distressed investors get involved on the debt side of things, buying the bonds and then working through the company as it works out, sometimes in bankruptcy court. But you attack this from an equities perspective, which one would think is pretty risky on the one hand, which makes it, of course, contrarian. And then secondly, the whole distressed cycle has kind of now been put on hold because of COVID largely. And they just, correct me if I'm wrong, but there just have not been all that many bankruptcies. Again, you don't deal with the actual bankruptcies, but put all that in there. And then also the fact that you focus on industrial companies where everybody else now is focused on tech and growth, or so it seems. And I thought that this would be a good opportunity to have you come on the podcast and discuss these things. So without me screwing things up anymore, why don't I kick it over to you and you tell us more specifically about your investing strategy.
All right. So what we do is we try to find companies that people think are going to become go bankrupt, more or less. So we're very valuation driven. So more or less, I try to buy things at less than 3x pre-tax free cash flow on the equity. So why 3x? 3x is good because if a lot of people think cheap's 7 or 10x, but ideally most of the companies I buy have a lot of debt on them, or they're in some kind of situation where people there's a refinancing cliff or something coming forward. So And a lot of the situations are actually deleveragings where they're using all their free cash flow to pay down the debt. So why three times? Three times is interesting because they can start buying back shares. Mm-hmm. And if you have a good capital allocator, they can be paying down debt. And then if they feel very comfortable that the maturity might be in 5 or 10 years or five or seven years, then they can stop paying down debt if the stock doesn't move, and they can buy back a third of the shares with their free cash flow. So ideally you want to have it below that sort of multiple, at least I think so. So it can have a meaningful impact. Whereas if it was at trading at 10 times earnings, 10% of the shares is not really a game changer. At least I don't think so, in terms of eliminating the share count. So more or less what we do is we try to find these companies that are going through some kind of situation, whether it could be a good co, bad co, or just some kind of turnaround where there's a good company that's growing inside of a legacy bad company that's declining in revenues, that the people don't understand that the good company is going to become the new company going forward. So if we can buy things that actually have a growth aspect to them, that are trading at extremely low multiples, so sub 3x pre-tax free cash flow, then it generally works out. I mean, there's some risk there. I mean, some people will be scared to touch things that are trading at that have a lot of debt. But there's some key nuances that you need to sort of pay attention to. A lot of people use debt to EBITDA as your metric to determine how much debt there is. But in reality, you should be really looking at debt to free cash flow, or pre-tax free cash flow, because you have to understand how long it's going to take them to actually pay down the debt. And if the company has a lot of CapEx, then EBITDA is not a good measure, right, to figuring out if a company's going to pay off their debt. Mm-hmm. So there are little nuances to our approach that mm-hmm. This generally occurs with industrial tech companies. Not that I'm against tech. I love tech. One of our largest positions now is a legacy industrial company that is turning into a tech business. So you get to buy this thing at a very, very low multiple. And then in the future, maybe get trades off sales. Mm. And that's how you can get our sort of hurdle is we want to try to find things that we think that we can make reasonably off reasonable multiples going forward 10 times in 3 years.
Wow. Okay. So that's a lot.
Basket of those. Then
3 years.
It worked out.
Yeah. I mean, that's an extraordinary return. I mean, private equity isn't that good, and they hold the companies for 10 years and, you know, do all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. I'm not saying I'm going to get those returns.
But sure. No, but still, that's a great goal to have.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
But those are very distressed situations for the most part.
Right. So now what's to stop a company from, and I guess this is where the special sauce comes in, and maybe you can tell us a little bit more about specifically what you look for in the cash flows. But what's a company, if they have a lot of debt, you know, the equity is the junior most tranche, right? And they can easily just kind of wipe out those people and default that, and then kick it over to and restructure and come out again as a public company later on. Obviously you don't want to do that too much, because then eventually people won't buy anything, but especially nowadays, like what's to keep a company from doing that?
Okay. So there are a couple things that work, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of growing free cash flow. One thing is when a company has a high interest rate, a above market interest rate, and it's a legacy piece of debt or something like that, right? And it seems like the company's stable enough that they should keep the level of EBITDA for the time being, right? So by refinancing a 10% interest rate where you might pay $50 million in cash interest, and that can decrease to $20 million, you're increasing free cash flow by $30 million. Hmm. Right? And that's a very easy way to get some growth in the business. That also accelerates the debt pay down going forward. Hmm. So there are little things like that you don't want to buy something with a 1% interest rate.
Right.
Because you don't get any leverage. You don't get an increase in free cash flow from paying down interest. Mm-hmm. We use EBITDA minus maintenance CapEx minus cash interest. Maintenance CapEx is a tricky number because a lot of companies will give you maintenance CapEx, but it's in reality, they should be including some of the growth CapEx in the maintenance CapEx. So
interesting. But okay. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. And so then, and obviously this is mostly, if not entirely, publicly available, the various debt covenants and the various, loans and stuff that the companies have.
You can call the IR and they'll walk you through.
Which is another thing that you do that not many people do, especially on the retail side, but it's a free country, it's a free market, and there's nothing to stop people from calling up the IRS department, which are all public
emails. You can ask, you can send the IR person an email asking ask them to walk you through the debt covenants.
Totally. Very interesting. That's really cool. All right. So, and I want to ask you a little later about, you mentioned positions and some ideas specifically that you have, but tell me more, a little more about the screening process and how that works out, how that works.
Okay. So I have a very different process than most people. I try to meet with, and this is something that's, it's hard to replicate on the retail side.
Sure.
But I try to meet with between 60 and 75 companies a week.
A week?
A week.
Okay. So you're busy.
I spoke to 2,500 companies because most of the situations I follow, either I'm looking for new, you have to, wait, screeners don't really work for this type of strategy because you're looking for declining revenues. Mm. You're looking for declining margins, stuff like that, where if you try to screen for it, you get a lot of like bad companies that show up, and then it's rare that you actually find. So what works is talking to management teams. You can go on companies' websites and listen to their investor presentations at conferences. Just go through 20 of those a day for 30 minutes. And that's more or less what I do, but I talk to the actual management teams. But I try to just hear what they're telling you. So a lot of situations, the reason why you want to focus on small caps, for example, is that most investment theses are pretty obvious, but you have to understand that they exist. So they're what, 10,000 different microcaps, or I think OTC, there are 10,000, NASDAQ, there's a bunch, there's a lot. No one can keep up with all of them. There's no research coverage, nothing. No one's following them. No one's keeping track of what's going on. Management's barely even talking to anyone. But sometimes they show up to a conference for the first time, and they're trading at 2x EBITDA, but EBITDA has been declining over time, and they have this new part of their business that's really growing, and they're trying to get the word out there, or the management teams are bad at communicating. So a lot of my process is just talking to them and understanding what they think, right? And what they think is going to happen. And then I have to figure out whether they're lying to me, which happens, sure, right? Or if it's better when someone's very optimistic about their business, because it saves you a lot of time. If someone comes to me and says that they think they can grow at 5% a year for the next 5 years, then I can just pass, and it's trading at 10 times EBITDA. I just don't care, more or less. But if it's trending at 2x EBITDA, let's say, oh, they're banging the table. Our stock's amazing. This company, this new product we have is amazing, but no one's listening to us because we've had this legacy business that everyone thinks that our legacy shareholders hate us, and we're trying to pivot. Those are the situations you want to find where no one's believing anything they're saying. And then you just do a bunch of work. You call up competitors, you call up suppliers, you call up their ex employees, customers across the board. And you try to figure out what they have, is it actually good? And then if you have confidence in the revenues going forward, that's when you get really, really good investments.
Okay, interesting. I mean, a couple of things here. I mean, isn't all management optimistic about their stock?
No. I mean, it depends. I mean, there are different types of situations. There are people that have a product that has zero revenues, and they think that they're going to become a $1 billion business one day, right? And it's like, all right, well, great. Like, maybe, you know what I mean? But it's more that you can find a lot of situations, and it might help if I give you a couple examples.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, do you want me to walk through our largest position right now?
Yeah, maybe let's do that. But let's just first take a quick break to give our advertisers a chance to be heard. If you are a premium subscriber, you do not get the break, so don't touch the dial. Keep it right here. To become a premium subscriber, go to the website contrarian.supercast.tech, T-E-C-H, and sign up.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host and access to private channels on our Discord server. They also get generous discounts to our virtual conferences and other services. And of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information. That's contrarian.supercast.tech.
I need to tell you about Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can absolutely recommend them. Their research is different. They do not cherry pick positive or negative charts, nor do they fall into the trap of confirmation bias. They have an intellectually consistent approach. They go through a consistent set of relevant data, put them through the same consistent set of frameworks, and then summarize the whole thing in a checklist with a concise written summary. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer, which is a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website merckresearch.com, sign up for one of the subscriptions, and enter the code CONTRARIAN at checkout to take advantage of this limited offer. That's merckresearch.com, M-E-R-K.
Okay, Chris Krug, your positions, let's have them.
Okay, so this is my favorite company right now. And to be clear, I'm a shareholder. This is not investment advice.
Sure.
So it's called Performant Financial. PFMT is the ticker. So this is about as hated of a company as you could possibly have in their legacy business. They're a collections agency for the IRS and student loans. So think about people that may own $5,000 to the IRS, or people that might owe a couple thousand bucks on their student loans. And they go into call center type business and they call and collect it from people. And with the new Biden administration, they've floated the idea of canceling all student debt, or at least canceling some of it. Right. And on top of that, over the last year, they haven't been collecting on student debt. Right. There was hold on collecting payments. So that's a legacy business. It IPO'd in, I believe, 2012. Parthenon, a private equity shop, owned it. And stock's gone from 15 bucks to, it bottomed out at 60 cents. So over time, they started this new business, a healthcare vertical. The healthcare vertical basically saves money for insurance companies. So they do two different things, eligibility and audit. Eligibility is you get into a car accident and you break your leg and you charge it to the car insurance company. In reality, it should be to the healthcare insurance. Okay. So they catch it and they save money. It's not a very labor intensive business. That's more like basically they have a piece of software that uses AI and it catches claims, right? Then they have audit. Audits after companies paid, they go and they audit the claims to make sure that they pay for the right thing. The insurance company paid. They audit to make sure that the claims properly coded. And they can save companies money save insurance companies money by catching false claimed healthcare related expenses. Okay. So you might have knee surgery and they charge you for something in the brain. So they catch that and they refute it and they save the company's money. And the business model is they save them, or they get paid 15 to 25% of the money that they're saved. So on the eligibility side of the business, it's mostly basically tech. And then on the audit side of the business, it's tech slash like a BPO because there's some human involvement there. But regardless, EBITDA margins, I think could get to on consolidated on the healthcare side, about 35% over time. So their competitors like Change Healthcare, HMSY had between 30 and 35%. HMSY is like one of the biggest direct competitors. It's also like a dying carcass for the most part. And they're just eating away. They, from what I've heard, from some of our expert calls, they haven't changed their software since 1995.
Damn.
From a couple different
That's
people.
Embarrassing.
Because they were a legacy company. I believe they got lazy. So Performant basically has this new software, or if you want to call it software, it's more or less a software that basically is replacing a bunch of HMSY's customers. So here's the math on it. So the company has $40 million in net debt, and it's a really bad piece of paper. It's a related party debt with a student loan servicer, ECMC Group, and the interest rate's between 5.5% and 10.5%, depending on if they hit certain debt to EBITDA ratios. They have to issue, it gets renewed every year. They have to issue warrants every year to renew the piece of paper. It's really bad. And in a market environment like this in 2019, I believe they paid the 10.5% interest rate. Now they're paying 5.5, but they should be able to get a lower interest rate. So that's your first catalyst. It's sometime this year, I believe that they're going to refinance. Then they have, on top of a business that did $20 million in EBITDA. So two times, which is not the end of the world, but there's a high interest expense. There's $4 million in maintenance CapEx. So it's maybe four times or so pre-tax, debt to pre-tax free cash flow. But the key of the story is they just sold their legacy, or they're in the process of selling, they sold some of the contracts of the legacy student loans business. So they're using that money to pay down the debt. So you have $120, $130 million market cap. Then there's there's 55 million shares, and there's another 5 million warrants that strike at, I think, 96 cents and $1.96 or something like that. But then you have $40 million in net debt. They're selling part of the business. I think that they can get somewhere between $5 and $10 million for the sale of all their contracts, which is not a huge amount, but it's some, you know, yeah. What I mean? And that's deleveraging the business. I think going forward, they're going to be able to pay down. They're going to lower their interest expense, so the free cash flow is increasing. So they're going to have less interest from less debt, and also the interest payments are coming down. So last year they did $68.9 million in revenue on just healthcare for $120 million market cap for something that can do 35% EBITDA margins going forward. That's pretty good. That's this year. This year they're guiding to $83 to $90 million in revenue. I think next year they're going to be able to accelerate that. So I think that within by 2023, 2024, they should be close to $200 million in revenue. Because there's a unique aspect to this business. A lot of people might come out and say, "Hey, we have this great product, we're gonna win all these contracts." But Performant actually has visibility for two and a half years. So this is the way the sales cycle works. Performant basically goes to these big insurance companies. Like they have United Healthcare, they have Humana, I believe they have Aetna as well. Now they're moving more towards mid-size insurance providers. And they go and say, "Hey, we're so much better than HMSY or what you're currently using. And we've done some checks and it seems as though it actually is a superior product. And we're so much better. Let us compete against your current process." So they come in and it takes 3 months to implement the first time. And they basically run a trial period for, it can take like a year. I might be a little bit wrong on that number, but it's something to that extent. So they know at some point during that process that they're beating the other person. Then they sign the contract at the end. Then it takes a year to integrate. Then the revenue doesn't show up for 3 to 6 months after that. So they should have visibility for an extended period of time. If you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, so I get that. Yeah.
They sign the contract, right? And then they should know for the next year and a half what they should know in a year and a half what their revenues can be.
Yeah. And that's pretty sticky revenue at that point.
Revenue. I mean, HMSY has been in this business since the 1990s and no one's disrupted them.
Wow.
So
why not? You know,
I think for a couple different reasons. I think number one, they deal with both the commercial insurance companies and CMS.
Okay.
And I think unless someone's really motivated to, I don't think this data is easy to get in the first place.
Right.
Because you're getting it from the insurance companies and CMS, and there are not that many vendors that actually deal with them. And then on top of that, I think that unless the product is significantly better, then it's not really worth it for companies to change because there's big integration expenses. Granted, the company Performant pays the integration expenses, but also you have pretty long-term contracts. You have 2 to 4 year contracts that have auto renewals on them.
Nice.
So there are other competitors as well, but HMSY is the biggest one. There's Change Healthcare. There's Cotiviti, which actually, HMSY actually got taken out recently. Same with Change Healthcare. They both got taken out between, I think Change was 13 times EV to EBITDA and HMSY was 15 times EBITDA. Okay. So right now you have Performant that potentially has I'm going to say potentially because I'm not in the industry, I don't know for sure, but I've had calls from multiple people that say that this product's better, a better product. That's trading at, we think in a steady state, they could do something like 35% EBITDA margins or at least 30% EBITDA margins. Hopefully they don't make EBITDA for the next couple of years because we want them to grow faster. But if they're trading at, so we can look at a revenue multiple. If you slap a 5x multiple on 2023, what I think could be a close to $200 million in revenue, then you've got almost a 10 bagger there.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. PFMT, I just looked here, it's trading around $2.22 a share, which is kind of right where it's been over the last 5 years. I mean, you mentioned it did drop down into the
But it was a pretty different business now because they're getting rid of /they've gotten rid of a lot of the contracts. So now people are going to wake up and they're going to realize this is a tech business instead of a secularly declining collections agency.
Yeah.
So that's great. And it's a real business. They have $70 million in revenue. They should have between 83 and 90 this year. I think in the future, they could have much more. And there should be a nice runway where they can really grow over the next couple of years.
Hmm.
And if so, any sort of tech multiple, then it's a...
Oh, yeah, then it's a different ballgame. And you think this is a good entry point around $2.20?
I think so. I mean, earnings are, I believe they have to be by May 15th, 45 days to the quarter end. So they should report next week. Mm-hmm. I think that they're probably going to give a lot more color on the healthcare business and what they think the healthcare business can do going forward. So I think right now is pretty good. I mean, we'll see. I'm not saying buy the stock, but do
right. Research. Of course, none of us.
I think it's very interesting at a $120-$130 million market cap. I think it's very appealing here.
Yeah, I was going to say now this company probably doesn't have all that much coverage on the sell side. Yeah.
So my process is I try to get them to talk to investment banks. Mm-hmm. Hopefully the investment banks can pick up research coverage. At least they can start going to conferences. The company has barely gone to any investment conferences. That's going to change going forward.
Hmm.
So people are going to start, and it's a complicated story. I broke it down simply, but it took 6 months to really understand how good the business was.
Hmm.
I'd been following this company since June or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I bought shares in January.
Of 2021,
increase my position.
Okay. Now you said you talked to 60 companies a week.
I try to. Yeah.
And how many positions do you guys have in the portfolio total?
We have a few. Four major positions.
Wow. Okay. So that's not a very big hit ratio.
Like 1% positions. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it obviously takes a lot for you to decide that you want to get into it. Right. Now, have you talked to management? What's management like there?
I love the management. Mm-hmm. I think they're amazing, especially for a small company. So, I mean, this company, to be fair, was almost a $1 billion company at one point.
Uh-huh.
And I think Lisa, the CEO, was dealt a bad hand with different administrations and just the hostility towards the student loans business.
Oh, yeah.
And she had the guts to more or less completely switch the business model and then in turn sell the legacy company and completely switch into this healthcare vertical. So originally this healthcare was just focused on CMS. Then she started to go to the commercial payers, and now they're dominating the commercial payers. And they're dominating. They're starting to really win in the commercial payers as well. And there's more way for growth. But I think she's fantastic.
Awesome. All right.
Same with the CFO. CFO's great. It's especially for a small cap, you meet so many small cap investment management teams that are not good at all. So I think it's great.
Mm. Now, what if here, to bring the macro picture in just a tiny bit, the interest rates go up and it becomes harder to refinance that debt? I mean, you expect this to be imminent, that big slug there.
The reason why I'm confident that it's going to happen is because I think it's going to, the debt comes due in August of 2023. So technically August 2022, and then they can sign a one-year extension. And I think they're motivated to get it done this year. Mm-hmm. And also, on top of that, they do generate cash flow. And so even if they still have $20 million in debt in 2023, I think that it could get refinanced pretty easily.
Very interesting.
It's not an outstanding amount of debt. It's not a tremendous amount of debt. So if I think once that sort of changes and they can get a real bank to give them a piece of paper, then I think it looks really appealing. But very I like cool. a lot of things when they're before that happens.
Yeah, exactly.
Interest rates could rise, and I think they will rise over time.
Sure.
But the reason why when I bought this thing originally, it was 2.5x EBITDA or something like that. Now it's trending at last year's EBITDA. Now it's trending at like 6x. Mm. But if you look forward, if you can use that steady state, that those EBITDA margins, it potentially is extremely cheap. Mm-hmm. And then, like mm-hmm. I said, if they can really get 35% EBITDA margins like their competitors, which I don't see why they couldn't. Over time, it's not going to show up tomorrow because hopefully they're growing, right? But if they can, then it should be trading 5x sales. That's basically 15x EBITDA.
Yeah.
If 15x EBITDA, it's almost a 10 bagger.
Mm. Fantastic.
Off a couple of years out.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. All right, Chris, I want to ask you some more about some other positions, not all of them, because I don't want you to give away your entire book, nor would I expect you to do that anyway. But first, I want to ask you a little bit about your background and how you came to, start Chatham Harbor Capital and how you came to invest in the first place. So can you tell us about that?
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
So I have another very, very unique background. I went to college at Clemson in South Carolina.
Yeah.
And my senior year in Clemson, I was going to become a business management major. And I was about to graduate and I took a finance class and I really liked it. So the next year I took something like 67 credits in a year. And
oh my God,
I got an entire degree. I was taking 10 classes a semester and so I didn't have an experience. So I was going to be a lawyer. That's my plan. But then I moved up and I worked for a small, broker shop and I was a trader. And then about after 2 years of working there, I started my own firm and then slowly, and that was 6 years ago or something like that. And then slowly we launched a couple funds and yeah.
Nice. And so the fund has been around now for about 5 years or so.
Our fund's been around for three and a half years.
Uh-huh.
Like that.
Wow. And before starting this, you just worked at retail brokers?
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. That's great.
Okay. But I was always, I'm a fundamental investor. Being contrarian, I do look at technicals.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I don't think a lot of people would admit that they actually do, but I think a lot of people actually do.
Of course. Yeah. And the technicals, I mean, we make fun of them, but they do kind of work. I mean, 200-day moving average and stuff. I mean, that's kind of like,
especially say something. For low price stocks and high price stocks.
Is that right?
If something's trading at less than 3x EBITDA or 5x EBITDA or pre-tax free cash, whatever number you want to use, that's irrational. So it's like, why can't it trade at 1x? Mm-hmm. So you have to look at the chart sometimes to sort of know. I mean, mm-hmm. with more money, I can move things more for smaller names now. So technicals work less. But you have to look at larger and larger companies.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I believe do matter, especially with indices.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm pretty bullish right now on the market.
Okay, that's good to hear.
Yeah, it depends what they're going to do with taxes.
Okay.
But so we'll see. Hopefully, they won't be too aggressive in terms of raising taxes.
I suspect it'll get watered down a bit from what they've anticipated hopefully. So far. I mean, that's been the pattern at least. Yeah.
The path of least resistance is up.
Exactly. Right now. Yeah.
So I think we might see 5,000 by the end of the year on the S&P.
Wow.
It's definitely
right around, what is it now, 42?
Yeah, 42 right now or something. Uh-huh. Like that. I mean, we just broke through 4,000 on the S&P.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're approaching 3,500 on the Dow.
Right. 35,000. Yeah.
35,000 Dow. On the NASDAQ, we're approaching 15,000.
Mm-hmm.
If we break 15,000 on the NASDAQ, then next stop is 20,000. I think these big round numbers actually do mean a lot.
Interesting. Okay.
Because people talk about them all the time.
Yeah. And you get the news coverage then people get in. Sure.
4,000, 4,000, 4,000, 4,000 mm-hmm. for months. And then they finally break it. There's no way that has to be important.
Mm-hmm. And so Clemson, any thoughts on Trevor Lawrence and how he's going to do in the pros?
Did you read he put his entire signing bonus?
Yeah, I did see that. Bitcoin,
Ethereum, and Dogecoin.
Yeah. All right.
We'll see.
Well, it doesn't mean he's a bad player, football player, but yeah.
He might like it.
Who knows? He may even be a good investor. I mean, Bitcoin, you know, that's been.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows?
I mean, we've been making fun of it, but it's been.
You've been
you
wrong.
Know, if you invested in Bitcoin in 2019, then, you know, you're sitting pretty. Anyway, okay, cool. All right, so let's talk more about your book. Tell me about some other companies that you've invested in.
Okay, we like. In general, we like industries that people hate. So
yeah.
We own private prison companies.
Nice.
I think those.
I mean, not nice that private prison companies are a thing, but yeah.
But I think private prisons are interesting. There's one CoreCivic that we own.
Okay.
CoreCivic, CBX, what's the ticker? CXW. Sorry, I should know that. CoreCivic, it's interesting because it was a REIT. There's Geo Group and CoreCivic. Those are the only two. And it was a REIT, and they switched to a C Corp. And they're potentially going to start buying back shares.
Huh.
I believe last year they did $400 million in EBITDA. This is a smaller position for us. We're still doing some work on it.
Okay.
They did $400 million in EBITDA, and the market cap's like 850 or something like that. So, and it's essentially a real estate company because they're sort of switching their business model. So Geo Group has more exposure to more of the like political risk than CoreCivic does. CoreCivic more does private prisons for ICE and the U.S. Marshals.
Okay.
So the argument is that with the U.S. Marshals is actually, they've had some hiccups recently with some of the U.S. Marshal contracts, but I'm not really sure how the U.S. Marshals can be able to house their inmates because there's only so much capacity of prisons.
Right.
And U.S. Marshals is the law enforcement for their lawyers, but they're law enforcement before people go to as they're getting tried.
Uh-huh.
So, you need to have your lawyers within a certain amount of distance of the actual person before they get convicted. So these inmates have to stay within. I don't know if there's an actual distance, but it needs to be in a reasonable distance to where their lawyer is. And if they're in Cincinnati, then you can't ship someone to Alaska. So whereas if you're a prisoner, a normal prisoner, after you get convicted, they can ship you, I believe, wherever.
If it's a federal crime, right? Yeah.
Federal crime, right, yeah. Right. So it's a better business for the most part. And they're also switching the business model a little bit. They used to own and operate the prisons. Now with some of their recent contracts, they build for the U.S. government and they take long-term leases from the U.S. government.
Huh.
So if you think about it holistically, like this is a business that's counterparty is the U.S. government. And for very, very long-term leases, why should it be trading at 2x EBITDA?
Right.
If you take out the political risk, like if you take out what the business actually is, it's a real estate company with a contract with the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm. And I guess in a way you're long illegal immigration if it's an ICE.
Not really. I mean it's not perfect. I don't think it's cheap enough yet. I mean, that's right. Why we have this is just a starter position for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
But it's potentially interesting to this industry because if we get over that hurdle and it becomes more okay, because this is the reason why you want to have a private prison, according to the company. I'm not taking a political affiliation at all in this, but they claim that the U.S. government needs them because they can build prisons in 3 years versus 10 years it takes U.S. government. The U.S. government is not in the business of building prisons, where this company is in the business of building prisons.
Uh-huh.
So they claim that they're going to actually grow going forward.
And so these, again, most of the contracts are from ICE and U.S. Marshals?
U.S. Marshals, yeah.
As opposed to
the capacity of actual prisons along the border.
Right. And so these are federal contracts,
yeah,
right? Because ICE is a federal agency. Yeah.
It's look, like things are going to go wrong at this. There's going to be a lot of political heat. And that's why it's not a huge position for us. But since this is a contrarian podcast, mm-hmm. it's an extremely contrarian stock.
Yeah.
But it could work.
Yeah.
It could work if a new administration comes in or there's some settling down in terms of the political rhetoric right now for the most part.
But also, I mean, this is one of those things. I mean, is anybody in the news or anything really tracking like construction of private prisons on the border? And is like, it's not like they're going to stop building them just because of some political pressure, are they?
Right, exactly. Apparently, behind closed doors, the government's very very receptive to them. But
right.
It's sort of a political thing. So we tend to, like, we've invested in coal mines in the past.
Yeah.
Coal mines.
Right.
We have a decent sized position in this company, Civeo, CVEO.
Uh-huh.
Civeo, we were buying that as oil was collapsing. But what Civeo does is they do remote accommodations, so hotels.
Okay.
At at oil sand mines and met coal mines. So as you know, oil sand mines have a lot of upfront CapEx, but when you actually extract the oil from the sands, then it's very cheap to do. So we were buying this at 1.5 times free cash flow or something like that. It probably can grow going forward. It's not going to grow at 100% a year, but free cash flow should grow going forward, especially due to the fact that they're paying down their debt. But they have these hotels basically in the middle of the nowhere housing, workers.
On
met coal mines, which is steel making coal, and steel's not going away.
Yeah.
And then oil sands, which is, I mean, I think they can extract coal at $20 oil at $20 a barrel. It's not going to be a problem. Right. Oil sand mines are not, these are really long life projects. Mm. So this thing was getting destroyed. It's a legacy spinoff. Whatever his name is, David Einhorn was involved a long time ago. And the position ended horribly for them.
Yeah, that's for a lot of his positions, but yeah.
Yeah, it was a spinoff that they were trying to turn into a REIT.
Uh-huh.
And it coincided with oil collapsing. So it was just a disaster, and it spun off at $15. And then I can't remember what our cost basis was, but we were buying in the 60s.
Right.
After oil went to 60 cents, after oil went to negative.
Yeah.
So I like when an industry is getting destroyed.
Yeah.
There's actually long-term contracts, and it's a very good business. Mm. Not saying I'm buying Google, but very solid businesses that are not going away that you can buy at very, very low multiples.
Mm. Mm.
Now studio is getting a little bit more expensive, but it's still cheap. I mean, they're going to do, I believe, between $90 and $95 million in EBITDA this year.
Okay.
With a $250 million market cap.
Hmm. So, all right.
And it can grow over time.
That's interesting. But let's go back to this prison story here, because that really is contrarian, as you said. So, all right. So talk to me. So they construct the prisons, which are, I guess, low security, since they aren't violent criminals.
Yeah. They also do other types of rehabilitation. I mean, the argument that they would, and I'm not taking a political stance on this,
but the
argument that they would make is that the inmates are safer.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the old prisons are from the 1800s.
Wow.
And they're basically replacing them with new high-tech facilities that can do it cheaper. It's costing less electricity. A lot of the maintenance a lot of the maintenance on the old prisons is more than it would even cost them in a lease.
Huh.
So it's just, there's so much political hatred towards this
that sure.
it's trading so cheap. But in reality, if you looked at it, like if you forgot that it was prisons and it was just, we left that out, then it makes sense why it should be trading at a higher multiple.
Yeah.
Industries go in and out of favor.
Right. Although private prisons, I can't really see ever being in favor, but
yeah, it's not going to be in favor. But it probably
Nevertheless, yeah.
I mean, Massachusetts is coming up for a contract. They just won Alabama. I think Hawaii. I believe Idaho as well.
Oh, so these are state governments then that are doing this.
Yeah, but behind closed doors, these states are going to them, and they're potentially going to win contracts in those states. And there could be growth going forward.
How much of this business is state versus federal? Do you know?
I can't remember off the top
of my head.
It's a new position for us.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess it isn't that big of a risk to have the state contracts because states are, I mean, some are more leveraged than others, but they're still going to make their payments probably.
Yeah. A lot of what I do is we look at a lot of companies, like I was saying before, we have starter positions in a lot of companies.
Right.
And then over time, it takes me a long time to actually have a lot of confidence in the name.
Right.
So I've been following Performant for over a year. And so I know it very well. I've done a bunch of calls. Like, we know it very well.
Hmm.
CoreCivic, I don't know as well, but it seems like an appealing potential investment idea.
Mm. Yeah, it sure does. Yeah, that's definitely the type of thing that one would look for as a contrarian.
In the small cap game, you're doing volume.
Yeah.
You're not, a lot of people spend a lot of time on a lot of different companies. But in reality, what you're looking for in the small cap space is you need to do the work. I'm not saying you don't need to do the work, but it's you need to look at thousands of names because so many things that the company's pivoting all the time. There's always new news that you have to keep paying attention to stories evolving. And also, small caps are extremely volatile. Mm. They're not covered. Small caps are what you need to, it, all big hedge funds. They started in small caps. They made great returns, and then they raised too much money, and now they can't do it anymore. A lot of people look to Warren Buffett for advice. Sure. In reality, if you have $125 billion in
capital, something like that. Yeah.
Okay, fine. I'm going to listen to him when that happens. Yeah. But in reality, even Warren Buffett says, not, I don't like to quote him, but he knows he can make 50 or 100% a year if he had $1 million, right? Yeah.
Nice.
Like, you can't do that buying Apple. I mean,
no, you sure can't.
You could, but I mean,
20 years
over a long period of time, you're not going to do that.
Right.
So I think the points of things that could be helpful to people are, you need to look at small companies.
Mm-hmm.
You need to look at cheap companies that are not going to go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit more difficult to find. But I think it's really, really important to look there. You can find people, you can find companies on screens. The 52-week low list used to be great.
Used to be.
Now it doesn't really exist anymore.
Right. Right. That's right. Yeah.
Let's see.
Crazy. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about, I was going to ask you something and I forgot. Oh, crap. Anyway, go ahead. I'll think of it.
Let's see. So that our process in as you need to look at as many companies as possible. You need to be agnostic about the industry. Try not to take risk in super speculative things.
Mm.
So in drugs, sometimes you can make
biopharma is a whole thing.
Yeah. Spec pharma. You can make money in that, but it really,
you're just gaming the approval process. Yeah,
exactly. Like, for example, what you may want to look for is companies after they've gotten approved, like medtech companies.
Okay.
I found some good medtech names after they've gotten approved that more or less people don't believe in their ability to roll out. So some ways to make a lot of money in small caps are companies that have raised a lot of money in the past. This is difficult to do, so don't get me wrong, but companies that have raised a lot in the past that claim that they're not going to raise money in the future. And they're trading really cheap off next year or the following year's numbers if they don't raise any money.
Okay.
So you're always looking for dilution, right? Especially with healthcare stuff.
Yeah.
But that's a hard way to, it's a hard business to run.
Dilution is a bad thing if you're an existing shareholder.
Oh, dilution is horrible. But if the dilution already happened.
Oh, I see.
A lot of these companies that raise a lot of money just keep going down.
You're right.
They constantly believe, and they keep doing reverse splits because people constantly believe they're always going to raise money. And sometimes they're screaming at you that they're not going to raise money. Sometimes a lot of times they're lying.
Yeah.
But if you can actually go through the numbers and you can actually figure it out, then and there's a good probability that they won't, and trust management. It might be worth taking a small position. Another thing I have for you. You don't always have to look at the US markets. Some of the best ideas I've been finding right now are on the AIM in London, which is basically, you can call it the OTC in London.
Yeah. Now you're sounding like our friend Artem Fokin. He was on the podcast to talk about that.
Exactly. Yeah. Artem and I are going through every single company on the Australian Stock Exchange.
Yeah, he loves Australia. Yeah.
Yeah. But there's also the Toronto Venture. There's the CSE, all these different exchanges. Like, a lot of people are really interested in SPACs. Well, in Canada, you have these things called CPCs, capital pool corporations, I think they're called, and they're basically mini SPACs.
Uh-huh.
They're these, you can raise between $5 and $10 million. I think it was five, and they just raised it to 10. You can raise $10 million, and you had 2 years. Now the rules have changed a little bit, but in reality, you raise money, and then you go try to find a company to merge into.
All right.
And then these investment banks basically do the merger, and they do some sort of pipe. And a lot of tech companies are going public in Canada, like a lot of med tech companies and not med tech, healthcare software.
Uh-huh.
But that's an interesting place. If I was looking at larger cap, I would look at new issues.
Mm. So
I think a lot of these SPACs might be good companies, but they're going to be really good investments. I think they're going to probably all trade down together at some point. We used to look at SPACs all the time. But SPACs, you buy SPACs when they're $2.
Right.
After no one, because there's a reason why they're going through SPAC and not an IPO.
Sure.
Australia's great. Canada's great. A lot of, you might want to find companies in Australia, Canada, London, they're going to uplist to the United States.
Right.
Those are great opportunities because I just went to the Stifel tech conference, which is great. But it was a bunch of companies that potentially could uplist. Mm. And that's where you can find companies, the tech companies that have probably just as good technology as a lot of US companies. And a lot of them are US companies, just not listed in the United States. They trade it on EBITDA, which in the United States, all you have to do is uplist to NASDAQ and you basically get a higher multiple.
Yep. Yep.
So interesting. Things like that are very interesting ways to make money in an environment like this.
Yeah. We've spoken about a disparate topics here, because small caps obviously run the gamut from, you name it, any type of industry. Is there any way that you, any communities that you have online or elsewhere to kind of, for people to discuss these things, or is it just something where each one is individual and you have to explore it on its own?
I mean, there's some websites. I mean, like Value Investor Club.
Okay.
Seem to like, but that tends to be a little bit larger. Ian Castle's Microcap Club, which is great. I mean, Ian's created something amazing there. Something that people could do is they could start going to Chris Lahiji's LD Micro, which is an investment conference. And you can start meeting with management teams, or Bobby Kraft's Planet Microcap. And those are great conferences, or at least watching them. You don't even have to meet with management teams, but at least watching as many presentations from those conferences as possible.
Right.
And you can at least hear the story. What's important, I think, at least, is listening to what management is saying. This is trying to come up with your own opinion on it.
Right.
First. A lot of people think they know what an industry is doing.
Right.
But in reality, if management's yelling at you that it's something completely different, then either you're right or they're right. So I think it's very beneficial to just go to these conferences. I think they're amazing. I mean, Chris's and Bobby's conferences are, I think, the best out there.
Cool. Okay. Good to know.
Yeah.
If you can send me those links, or I'll try to find them. I'll put them in the show notes.
Sure.
All right. Chris Krug of Chatham Harbor Capital. By the way, is that a reference to Cape Cod or anything?
Cape Cod.
Okay. You just like the name or the...
I used to go there when I was...
So. Oh, cool. Okay. That's a far away from North Carolina, but
yeah, it is pretty far. But my family's from the north.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
cool. Well, in closing, maybe tell us how listeners how they can find out more about you or about your firm.
Sure, you can go to our website chathamharborcapital.com or Twitter at chcap, chcap 2016.
Oh, cool. All right, that's good. I didn't know you were active on Twitter.
I'm not that active.
2016. Okay, cool. Well, at least I have somebody to reference when I put out the podcast. Awesome. Well, thank you, Chris Krug, for joining us on today. Thank you all for listening, and we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.